We are running over a very long period, and consequently we have to just select the most important things to discuss. But you remember that at the year 1000 A.D., the papacy had sunk to such degradation. It was the plaything of petty Roman nobility who were fighting among themselves, and it had sunk into such utter degradation that surely it would have disappeared before long if it had not been for the intervention of the German emperor. But the German emperor found that in his effort to establish order and to maintain control over the large part of Europe, which he was nominally leader of, he found that it was tremendously helpful to have a church authority that would stand by him and that would crown him as emperor. And so he intervened and did away with the terrible degradation into which the papacy had sunk, and tried to have men of higher character hold this position, which had such an influence by this time all through Europe. But he would never have succeeded in this. It would have been just a petty adjunct to his power, as became the case in the Eastern Church, where the emperor in Byzantium, in Constantinople, reigned supreme, and the church authorities were pretty much subject to his tyranny. And that, of course, would have been a very unfortunate situation. That's what would probably have happened if it had not been for Hildebrand. So Hildebrand is one man who has exerted a tremendous influence upon the course of history. We saw how in the 11th century, largely through Hildebrand's influence and also the influence of the Cluny revolt, of the Cluny reform, with which Hildebrand was connected, how the papacy, from being a position held by petty princelings and weak brigands, became a position which could vie with the emperor for authority throughout Europe, and, in fact, in some ways be superior to the emperor, because the emperor had a certain amount of power in Germany, in Switzerland, Austria, and Italy, and a certain nominal claim elsewhere, but practically nothing outside of those. But that's a large, large area. But the Pope was recognized in England, where he had his greatest support of all. And he had considerable authority in those parts of Spain which had been freed from the Muslims, and a very considerable authority in France. And so the struggle between these two went over a period of a couple of centuries. We're not going into the details of that struggle. I want you to be aware of the fact that it existed during this period. But we noticed that the century which we had begun to discuss when we were last together, the 13th century, was the century of the greatest power of the papacy, the greatest power in its history. It was the century when the first pope in this century, Innocent III, who reigned from 1198 to 1216, had carried out the claims that many popes have made before and since to a greater degree than any other pope ever has in history. He interfered in English affairs to so great an extent that after the barons forced King John to make the Magna Carta, which is generally recognized as the beginning of English liberties, the Pope ordered John to cancel it. And he ordered John, he placed John under an interdict that there could be no religious services in England. And John, in the King of France, prepared to conquer England for the Pope. And John surrendered completely and turned over England to the Pope, to belong to the Pope, and then receded back from him as a fief, and claimed he was only ruling it as the Pope's representative. Now, the English did not recognize that, but the Pope, for a period of some centuries after this, continued to exert claims that England was their actual property. And they did, as a matter of fact, have more authority in England than almost anywhere else outside of Rome itself. up to the time of the Reformation. And they probably received a larger income proportion to the number of people from England than they did from any other country up to the time of the Reformation. So Innocent III interfered in the affairs of just about every state in Europe, and in most cases was able to carry out his demands. In many of the cases, he was criticizing the rulers for some sort of immorality or for something that was definitely wrong, and forcing them to give it up and to submit to his claims. And he is the most powerful of all four. There was nothing in his reign that was as dramatic as Hildebrand meeting the Emperor Henry IV at Canossa, making him stand in the snow there barefooted for 3 days before he would be defeated. But Hildebrand was building the power. Innocent III was able to exert it. Then we glanced ahead through the century, not looking in detail at succeeding popes, but noticing how they tried with varying success to exert the same power that Innocent had exerted through this century. And eventually, the power was so great that the various rulers of different parts of Europe became tremendously interested in who would be the next pope when one died, and it got to where it would be 3 or 4 years before they could get one elected by the Roman people or by the cardinals. There was considerable changing as they gradually developed the system of having it be restricted to the cardinals, which before the end of the century was definite. It was only the cardinals who would elect the pope. And we noticed Celestine V, how the cardinals tried to elect a stopgap. And they elected this old man whom everybody considered very saintly, who had been a hermit for many, many years. And then one of the cardinals, who was very shrewd, may have succeeded in persuading Celestine V to resign, or it may have been simply that Celestine himself recognized that he just didn't have the background or the qualifications for a position of this type. It was hard to say, we don't know the exact facts. But anyone reading about it cannot but have great sympathy for Celestine and feel rather aggrieved at the character shown by this cardinal who succeeded in his bonification. There was long discussion as to whether Celestine V had the right to resign. Could a pope resign? Was he not established of God in this position and therefore in it as long as he lived? Well, Boniface settled it by giving his infallible opinion that his predecessor did have the right to resign. We notice how Boniface VIII, they said, came in like a fox, ruled like a lion, and died like a dog. And to this day, Boniface's statements of the great power that the Pope claimed are quoted today by some of those who support the strong authority ideas for the Pope. He expressed it perhaps more strongly than almost any other Pope. However, as having surveyed the papacy during this century, we should notice next. Yes? Yeah. He came into collision with the King of France. And he tried to exert authority over the King of France like Celestine, Innocent III had. And the French troops came actually to Rome, and he fled. He fled to another town where he was seized by the troops and so brutally handled as they seized him that when he died shortly after, it was generally thought to have been the result of the seizure. So that's why they said he died after that. But it was, we cannot sympathize with the way that the French troops treated him on this occasion, but it was a big come down from the claims he made for these who were claimed to be as loyal to the Pope as any group anywhere to have treated him in this way. I thought I had discussed that last time, but it's easy to forget those things, and I appreciate your asking about it. Now, this was a quick survey of the century as far as the papacy was concerned. But there are a number of other matters during this century that are of great importance in church history. And the first of those I'm going to look at, we call capital B, the Albigensian Crusade. I did not give you a B before, did I? Because if I had, it would have been what I'm now going to give you, a C. It's hard to arrange these things so that what is necessary to understand one thing is given before, when you're dealing often with things that are parallel in time. And I decided just last night that the Albigensian Crusade would be better discussed before the Mendicant Orders than after. And so I have arranged it in this order, which I never did before when I've given the course, but I think it's a good logical order. And it certainly is a good chronological order, because it comes right at the beginning of the period. And it shows that the situation, the papal power here, was not something that just stood of itself. It took a great effort to maintain. And one of those great efforts is involved in this, the Albigensian Crusade. Now that is a matter that not a great deal is said about, as a rule. I think the reason it's not said is twofold. One is, it's far enough before the beginning of Protestantism that there's so much that Protestants are tremendously interested in connection with the things that led up to Protestantism and with the original development of Protestantism, that they tend to overlook this development of three centuries early. So that most Protestants don't say a great deal about the Albigensian Crusades. In fact, most probably know very little about it, so the evidence of it is full and complete in all the books dealing with this area. Now, the Roman Catholics don't say much about it, because I think most of them are rather ashamed of it. And in Maturin's book here, he gives just a very brief summary of the facts about it. Says very, very little about it. But it is something that I believe we should know about. Now, last month I discussed with you briefly, under the previous century, the nature of the Albigensian. And I don't know whether any of you remember it now. It was one of various subjects we spoke of. I think I had better resume it a little. But it is important to understand this, to know what the Albigensians were. During the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages, when the wild Germanic tribes were gradually becoming civilized, Arianism disappeared rather quickly. And the Christian teachers, some of whom were very earnest spiritual people, some of whom were not, many of them had comparatively little education, comparatively little knowledge. There is no evidence, no historical evidence, of any group of Christians through the Middle Ages unconnected with the established church. There is purely a myth that there was any such group that had a continuous existence through the Middle Ages. There were the established churches here and there which often had leadership very little trained, often had leadership greatly interested in political affairs and not much in religious affairs. But all through the Middle Ages, there were some who studied the Bible. What they were in, or at least connected with, the established church, up to the 12th century. We have no evidence of any others during this period. Most of the heresies of the ancient world disappeared in the course of the onrush of the barbarians and the degeneration of civilization in the early Middle Ages. But there is one which seems to have continued to quite an extent, and that is the old Manichaeanism, which Augustine had. This was, I don't know if you really call it Manichaeanism, but it's near enough to it to make it pretty hard to think there was not some definite connection between the Manichaeanism, which was quite strong in Augustine's time, and this which they seem to call Albigensianism, because of its having a great headquarters that is being largely centered around a town called Albi in southern France. But they call themselves the Cathari, C-A-T-H-A-R-I, which means the pure one. And the Manichaeans took the old Gnostic view, and the Albigensians called them in it, that there is separation between the physical and the spiritual, and the physical is bad, and the spiritual is good, and everything physical is bad, and everything spiritual is entirely separate from that which is physical. the body is bad. They took a dualistic position, which is definitely not a Christian position. But they did take great attention to the Bible, and in their standards that they claimed at least, they held a standard of morality which was certainly superior to the average practice standard in the leadership of the established church. But as early as 1100, these Albigensians began to spread rather widely in Europe and to take a strong stand against the established church, to hold that one was lost, damned forever, if he belonged to the established church at all. They could have no connection with it. They did away with baptism and the Lord's Supper. They had ordinances of their own that were different. Everything connected with human physical, ordinary human physical relationship, they considered bad. Thus, they considered that eggs were the result of carnal intercourse between animals, and therefore you couldn't touch an egg. It was a wicked, grave sin on their part to eat an egg or to have any connection with it. They took the ascetic attitude which we find in the Roman Church, and among some of them at least, carried it to a great extreme. There were those of their people whom they called the perfected. Most of their people were the teachers. But the perfected, they were people who had gone through a special ceremony, and they were supposed to have attained perfection of life. Now these Albigensians were found in various parts of Europe, but from 1100 on, they increased very rapidly in southern France, a little in northern Spain, most largely in southern France, until it came about that the whole southern third of France was almost entirely Albigensian. And the movement seemed to be growing at such a rate that it looked as if it would completely displace the Christian church throughout Europe. And Innocent III decided the only way that you could make this Albigensian growing movement was by having a crusade against it. Now by this time there had been four crusades. Four, that is what we call four main crusades. There were various other crusades, that is large numbers of people going to the Near East to conquer Jerusalem, to take Jerusalem from the Muslims, and most of these people, many of them being killed or taken to slavery. The established armies that went did conquer a good deal there, but then usually fell to fighting among themselves and it didn't last long. They did hold Jerusalem for about 60 years. It was over the first crusade. And the second crusade came when it fell, the temple regained. But now there had been four crusades against the Muslims to recover the Holy Land. Innocent said, this Albigensian movement should have a crusade against them. And he called on the Count of Toulouse, T-O-L-O-U-S-E, Toulouse, who evidently had control over about the southern fort of France, that's a really large area. He called upon him to root out this heretic from his territory. Now, the Counts of Toulouse were among the greatest leaders in France. One of the Counts of Toulouse had been one of the principal leaders in the First Crusade, 100 years before. And Raymond of Toulouse knew that his so many of the people in his area were Albigensians, it was just impossible for him to root them out. And so he pled with the Pope to use more gentle methods toward them, to be not to insist on this, but the Pope said, you must root it out entirely from your land, or you are to be excommunicated. And Raymond was excommunicated because of his failure to use vigorous methods to root out Albigensians. And when, as a result of the crusade was free, and the armies began to gather, and many thousands of troops began to be heading towards that area, Raymond made a complete surrender, and then he was ordered to do penance. And he had to kneel and be whipped, publicly whipped by various priests, and he had to go barefooted in processions, and he submitted to all sorts of things. in order to get back to try to stop the armies from coming, but the army still came because he did not root out heresy from his land. In fact, he could not have done it. And so the result was that in what was the most prosperous area of France, in the years between 1209 and 1214, in those 5 years there was constant fighting, town after town was taken and all the people killed. Those who were considered as the perfected, those who had taken this ceremony of declaring that they were completely apart from physical sin, these, when captives were burned at the stake, many of 200 at a time. And others were killed, the people, with ruthless cruelty. In some cases, they were not. For instance, in the city of Carcassonne, when it was taken, the people were allowed to go, to leave the city, but could take only the clothes on their back and not take anything with them. And the people from all around fled in terror. And southern France, from being the most cultivated and well-to-do section of France and one of the best sections of Europe, became really a desert. And the leader of the crusading army took over in place of Raymond of Toulouse, took over the control there. This man, who was one of the Normans with possessions in England and also in France. Yes? No, they were aggressive in their teaching, yes, but not in fighting. They, I know, they made no attacks on other people. I know of no instance of their trying by the sword to extend their control at all. Yes? He declared that anyone who would join the crusade against the Albigensians, if he died in battle, would go immediately to heaven. And he gave a special indulgence to anyone who would join. And there were great numbers of soldiers from all over Europe, particularly from northern France. Yes? Yeah, quite. They claimed to believe the Bible. They claimed to, they were often quoted verses. And they quoted many very fine verses. And on the moral standards they maintained were on the whole quite high, though rather extreme in certain regards. We don't know it from money thought about their views. And about their, what many things we know is from the evidence that the trials of some of them. And this is not a good and a good source as a rule to get full information. So we have, you see, they were rooted out completely. They were destroyed. And there was no effort made to try to preserve any of their books or anything like that. And in fact, anybody who would declare sympathy with them was in danger. And as far as the Albigensian movement is concerned, it was utterly destroyed with fire and the sword. And the only trace, the only thing that is left in church history, actually, aside from the death of these multitudes of people and the misery they went through, is the fact that men like Martin Luther, in standing against the Pope, knew what had happened to movements which had been far greater than Martin Luther's movement appeared when they declared that he should be shot. And so it exerted an influence on people's minds and attitudes and gave great fear to them when they would think of opposing the Pope. Oh, no. I don't. Not the Albigensians. I don't think we would say that. Of course, there's this we must say. How much knowledge is necessary for salvation? It's pretty hard to say. During all through the Middle Ages, there were those who trusted in the death of Christ on the cross. for salvation, and undoubtedly for faith. And there are many people today who trust in Christ but have very little knowledge and are saved. And it is pretty hard for us to say what individuals are saved and who are not. But there are people who know a great deal and who aren't truly trusting in Christ and who are lost, who may be very orthodox in their beliefs. And there are people, very simple people, who are saved with very, very little knowledge. Now, there may have been many evidences like that. But the evidence is pretty definite that the main teaching proclaimed by that were not in the area of Christianity. Now, there were two groups at the time, as we mentioned when we looked at the previous centuries, them and the Waldensians. We don't know a great deal about what the Waldensians held at this time, but we have no evidence of the Waldensians holding a view which were Gnostic, as we do of the Albigensians. And when the Reformation began, the Waldensians felt this is exactly where we stand. And they took the teachings of the Reformation over gladly. And some think the Waldensians had held them right along, and others think they had held them to only a slight extent, but yet, enough to feel this was where they wanted to stand. We don't know. Our evidence of the Waldensians is much less. The Pope did not consider the Waldensians a danger like the Cathars. There were far less of them, and they were poor people, and they were persecuted from time to time, but never was there a great imposition against them, or never was there a great crusader like the Cathars. Yes?
I too heard that, what you said.
Yes.
I was wondering what exactly do they teach in when they do the Lord's suffering?
Yes. Well, they had some special ceremonies, different ceremonies, but we don't know a great deal about them because it was destroyed as far as possible. And we don't know a great deal about them. Most of what we know is from later on when the few who remained as secret Albigenses were sought out by the Inquisition and tried and killed. We have some evidence of the proceedings of the trial. That is, you see, that's not very full. There were no reporters going among them at this time trying to write articles to describe their particular views. And any books they wrote themselves were destroyed. But they are not considered as the mainstream and Orthodox Christian group by any scholarly Christian teachers that I know. But it is true that through the ages, there have been, like in ancient times, in the ancient world, there were the Gnostics, who were denied so many Christian teachings. But then there were the Montanists, who, some will just class with the Gnostics and the Montanists. But we know enough about the Montanists to know that though they were extreme on certain points, there's no evidence of their being heretical at all. They were accepted group. And then there's the Novatians, of whom we have definite evidence in ancient times, that they were definitely Orthodox. They're but unconnected with the established church. They had their own church, their own leadership, and they existed till maybe 67th century AD when they disappeared. But through the years from the 6th century up to the 10th, we have no evidence of any group of any size that is standing against the established church. And Waldensians definitely began at about 1100. And the Albigenses, we don't know whether some of them may have been in this period of time. We have them coming in 1100 to 1200, so we become this great number of them. And as to just how they started, we don't know much about them. But it's very unlikely there was any size or number of them during the previous 400 years. Well, I didn't expect it would take this long on the Albigenses. It is indeed, when you take the tens of thousands of people involved in it, and the tremendous amount of destruction, it is something which to the people living then was a pretty big event, as were the Crusades. But as far as its effect on church history is concerned, the main, it had a number of indirect effects that we will notice incidentally. But the other matter that I thought of taking right here, but I'm going to take instead right after this, is one which has had great effect upon church history ever since, and which was indirectly connected with the Albigenses. And so we go on to see, which we'll call the mendicant orders. The mendicant order, M-E-N-D-I-C-A-N-T, the mendicant order. Now this is a development which has great effect to the present day. And it has been very important in the history of monasticism and very important in its effects upon Christian life, Christian scholarship, Christian activities, both effects for good and effects that weren't so good. And so it is something else that happened in this tremendously important 13th century. The Albigensian Crusade was mostly, it was 1209 to 14, and then there were sporadic outbreaks that were attacked by 1230. The Albigensians had disappeared as a fact. After that, there were individuals who were sought out, but it disappeared as a fact by that time. So it's mostly in the beginning of the century. But now the mendicant order is number one, general remark. General remark. This is, to anyone looking at conditions today, this is the most important development in, or one of the two most important, perhaps, the other being 300 years later, in the whole history of monasticism. And monasticism, as you know, is one of the most outstanding features of the Roman Catholic Church today, is monasticism. Now, as we notice, there is no evidence of monasticism prior, to any extent, at least, prior to 300 A.D. But by 400 A.D., there were thousands of monks. And we have simply a little evidence of Paul of Thebes, maybe, and of St. Anthony, a few before that time, hermits. Men who went apart to try to get away from the world, to try to develop their spiritual life out in the desert or off in the wilderness somewhere where they would be away from the temptations and distractions of the world. That was the original theory of monasticism. And that was the theory which was characteristic of practically all monasticism until this 13th century. And the mendicant orders introduced a new factor. We noticed that monasticism began with these individual hermits. Then they began grouping together into groups. Then the Benedict established an order. St. Augustine had tried to establish a set of rules for the monks who lived in one of his buildings where they tried to live a community life and develop their spiritual life, and he trained men there who became bishops in many parts of Africa. But the essential thing of monasticism was to get away from the world. Also, and the way history developed, if there had not been these monasteries where people were by themselves developing their spiritual life and maintaining something of the civilization of the ancient world, we might not even know today there's been a monastery. Hard to say. But the Benedict made a rule for it, and the Benedictine order remains to this day as one of the big orders of the Roman Church. So there have been many other orders that were established. Benedict wanted his men to work. Why? Because idle hands can easily get into mischief. It is easy for the devil to bring temptation when we are not doing something yet. And of course, he made a rule. Certain hours in prayer, certain hours in studying the Bible, certain hours in singing hymns, but also certain hours at physical labor. But it was all part of the attempt to maintain or develop the spiritual life. It was all directed for the people who were monks, for those who were in the monastery. It was not aimed at affecting the world outside. In the days of the Arian controversy, there were times when great numbers of monks in the midst of a great controversy would descend upon the city and would make a big stand against some heretical movement or something. But these were sporadic and incidental. It was no part of the purpose of monasticism. Now we get a new purpose with the so-called mendicant orders. And the development of these mendicant orders represents, in its inception, the interplay of two personalities. Two very, very different personalities. But these two different personalities have different objectives, different attitudes, but both of them quite different from most previous monastics. And the result was that each of them affected the other. And the result was that there developed this new movement which characterizes monasticism since that time far more than does the previous attitude of monasticism up to this period. Well, the new thing then is that these men wanted to become an order, not simply for developing spiritual life, but an order to affect the world. An order not to be shut off in a cloister somewhere, but an order to be out in the world having an effect upon it. Now, if instead of monasticism developing, there had been more stress on trying to reach people with the gospel, to be out in the world reaching them, and also to develop the spiritual life so that one could be a real effective witness for Christ, the whole history of the Middle Ages might have been very different. We can't say. It wasn't. It wasn't done. But now, the desire was to affect the world. And that was the purpose here of the mendicant order. Now, during the previous century or two, there had been a development of many new orders. And many a person had started, gotten a group of people around him, and started something like the Benedictine Order, maybe named after himself, maybe some other name because of some particular thing they wanted to stress. There were many different orders started. There are several hundred orders in the Roman Catholic Church today. But at this time, I was talking with a Roman Catholic one time at a chaplaincy dinner down in Washington, and he had his name and then CT after it. And I asked him, I said, what does a CT stand for? Well, he said, some of the fellows say it means can't preach, he said. And he went on and told me various jokes that people made about it, but then he finally got around to tell me that it means the congregation of the pastor. The congregation of the pastor. And I don't know anything about much about that particular order. There's the order of the Trappists in this country, which have a principle of trying not to say anything. One of them directs everything, the rest are supposed to say nothing through the day, and while they're eating, the one reads them from devotional literature. But they are supposed to not do any talking except the two or three who direct them. There are many different orders with different principles. We have an order across the street from us here called the Christian Brothers. That is an order established in France within the last three centuries by a man named Francis de Sales, and they are not priests, but they are to be teachers rather than priests. But they are a specific order for a specific purpose. South of us here, we have the Dominican Sisters across the street. That is one of the two orders that we are going to speak of now that started shortly after 1200. There were, during the previous century, there were many of these orders that got started. So many that Innocent III, at the Fourth Lateran Council, which was held in 1215, declared that there were to be no new orders established. No new orders established. There were too many already, he said. He said, from now on, anyone who wishes to become a monk, anyone who wishes to devote his life to accomplishing something for the church, must join one of the established orders. I suppose there were at least a couple hundred then. Many of them have died out by this time. But the funny thing is that the very man who gave that order went back on it by himself giving support to the establishment of two new ones, which are perhaps, well, if you name the four largest today, these two would certainly be among them. If you name the four most influential, these two would be among them right through this present day. They say that there's a legend, it may be a legend, it may have grown up later, it may have been an actual dream, Innocent had, we don't know. But at least according to the story that was told some decades later, Innocent III had a dream. And in his dream, he saw the Lateran, the walls of the Lateran palace starting to fall over. I suppose this was when he was greatly concerned about the Albigensian movement and whether they would succeed in destroying it. concerned about Somers' efforts to enforce what he thought was right upon the different rulers of Europe. He had this dream, according to the story, and he saw the walls of the Lateran Palace falling over, and then he saw two simple men in a monk's garb holding him up. And one of these was an Italian and one was a Spaniard. These were the two men who had been trying to get him to give his approval to the establishment, each of them, of the order that he wanted to establish. And, at any rate, Innocent III gave support to these men in establishing these two new orders, which were a change of direction, a very marked change of direction, and which are tremendously influential to this very day, and tremendously active. These men came to be called the friars. They're sometimes called the mendicants, sometimes called the friars. The word simply comes from the French brothers, but the term came to be applied to them in contradistinction to the older type of monks. Now we will, instead of going on to tell about details about what was different in these from previous orders now, and what there is similar in the two and what the great differences are between the two, because there are tremendous differences between them. And each of them would be very, very different if it hadn't been greatly influenced by the other in those early days. I think the best way to do that is to tell something about the two men involved, because they were men who exerted a tremendous influence. And I'm going to tell about them in the opposite order to that in which it is usual to tell them. That is, I'll tell about the one who, as a man, is less famous of the two. I will tell about him first. He was probably just as influential as the other one. But as a man, his life is less interesting. I suppose there might be 10 lives of St. Dominic that have been written. I don't know. But there are probably 200 lives of St. Francis that have been written. Francis is far better known than Dominic is. Dominic was probably, through the ages, has been just as influential in his results as Francis. But he might not have been if it had not been for the influence that each of these had on the other. Well, now, number two, then, is Dominic de Guzman. Dominic, D-O-M-I-N-I-C, G-E, capital G-U-Z-M-A-N. His enemies say he really didn't belong to the great, important Spanish family of Guzman, that he just took that name, or that he belonged to a lesser section of the family. Anybody who knows that actually blood has very little to do with a person's ability, and that almost any family will have, in the course of centuries, will have both geniuses and morons in it, realize that it doesn't make much difference, actually, what his connection was. But it may have helped him in getting recognized the fact that he had the name of this very influential Spanish noble family. But Dominic, as a young boy, was interested in going into the priesthood. And while he was not yet 10 years old, he went into a monastery, and there he studied. And he studied for over 10 years. He studied philosophy and theology. But he was a man with a desire not to study for the sake of studying, but to study in order to learn what the truth was and to spread it. And he felt that instead of the monks being simply buried away in the cloisters, singing hymns and reciting scripture and trying to develop their own spiritual life, they should be out with the great multitudes of people that knew practically nothing about Christianity, carrying to them what they knew. And so he was anxious to do this. And as a young man in his 20s, he went up into southern France and came in contact with the Albigensi and talked with them and tried to convince them of the errors of their views. And he did not make a great deal of headway in this, but as far as our evidence goes, Dominic's desire, personally, always was, to convert people by personal persuasion, by argument, and by evidence. Now, that was not true of a great many of his followers later on. But some have tried to make out that he tried forcefully, but there is no evidence of it. But he was appalled to see the great extent of Albigensianism and the fact that those who did not agree with him were so derided and looked down upon to these large areas here. He wanted to get people who would be trained, who would understand, who would know things, and to go out and present them. And so then, eventually, his order was established. His order, while it is generally called the Dominican, its actual name is the Order of Priests. And when you see a book written by a man, and after his name, it has capital O period, capital T period. That stands for the Latin word, which represents the Order of Priests. And the Dominicans call themselves the Order of Priests. So Dominic was anxious to have an order of men who would go out and who would reach people with ideas. That was his original attitude. And he gathered eventually a group of men about him. And in 1415, it was, he went to the Lateran Council, he appeared before the Pope, and he asked the Pope to give his approval to his establishing an order. And the Pope, and particularly the next one or two popes here, showed considerable strategy in their dealing with it. When they saw what an influential force this might be, they tied it to themselves. And so the new mendicant orders received privileges which no order had had before. Before that, an order of monks could have these services in their own buildings for themselves. But the local priests were the only ones who could hold services for the public. Now, the Pope gave these mendicant orders the right to hold services, the right to take confessions, the right to perform all the offices of the church without paying much attention to the local bishop. And you can imagine that made an awful lot of upset and confusion in subsequent years, but it gave the Pope, in the end, an army of men devoted directly to him, who could go all through Europe and could exert a tremendous influence, instead of the system which was similar to the old feudal system politically, where you had the emperor with the king, supposedly subject to the emperor, and then the duke subject to the king, and the count subject to the duke, and so on down. And if any one of these turns against his superiors, all the people who are under him are put in a pretty difficult situation, and the easiest thing for them is simply to stand with him. But the Pope now got his representatives everywhere that were directly responsive to him. That was part of the development. Dominic, I ought to give you his date. I didn't write down his date, but I have to give you for your notes. He was born in 1170, and he died in 1221. The book has a misprint here, 1121. But he didn't die 50 years before he was born. he gathered these men, and before his death, he had sent some of them out to different parts of Europe to establish centers where they would bring others into the order. Today, the Dominican order is probably the second most strongest order in Romanism. At least it's one of the first five. So the top one, of course, is the Jesuits that were founded 300 years later, which had some new aspects that come in after the Reformation began. But the Dominicans were established to preach and to present ideas called orders of preachers, but they were especially interested in combating heresy. And the Pope, when they established the Inquisition to root out the remaining Albigensians, ordered the Dominicans to take charge of them. And so through subsequent centuries, the Dominicans were the leaders in charge of the Inquisition. We look at the Inquisition separately later on. But the Inquisition was established and put in the hands of the Dominicans. Most of the leading inquisitors have been Dominicans. And people came to make a play on words. They took Dominic's name, and the name of his men, what have they called after him? They called him Dominicanus. And if you know Latin, you will see that Domine would be the Latin of God, and then Canis is the Latin word for dog. And so people called the Dominicans the hounds of God, the dogs that searched out the heretics. And they even represented pictures of the foxes fleeing with the dogs pursuing, and the word Dominicanus down underneath. But I don't think we can blame that on Dominic personally. Some have tried to do it, but the evidence, there is no definite evidence of his having any such idea. And though the Dominicans have been very, very active in the Inquisition and in the persecution of those with whom they differed, they also have been very, very active in scholarship, active in producing books and doing studies, often of a very high level, and they do a great deal of that today. The best Roman Catholic work in archaeology is largely done by Dominicans, by the so-called French Dominican school in Jerusalem. Well, we'll have to leave Francis till next time.